If you'll open up, this is, when we get into this thing, it might seem a little disjointed until we get to the third day. And then I think you'll begin to see how it all fits together. And you'll see the continuity in it. And you'll have to realize that I am starting at a disadvantage because I don't know what instruction you guys have had from your various regional directors and the various divisions. There is such a diversity of teaching. You know, where do you start when you have a workshop on developing a collegiate ministry? And so all I did was try to go back and do the things that I would do with a new guy going on a contact point. These are the areas that I would begin to help him begin to think about and give him the principles upon which to operate. So I'm starting at that point, and then we'll develop it as we go along. And so the first part of it, if you'll flip over your page there, is on planning and objective setting. Now, I don't know about you, but every time the summer rolls around and then I begin to get into the summer and start thinking about the fall, I begin to have these heart flutters and murmurs over this objective setting business and what in the world should we be doing and how many objectives to set. And, you know, I usually come up with a regular notebook on objectives. And about Christmas time, I realize that I haven't looked at that thing since I wrote it in the fall. And so I began to realize that, boy, I better get this thing nailed down on a few specific objectives that I want to accomplish. And not make it too complicated. So we'll just start right in on this overlay, which will match up with your notebook, hopefully. You all see that? If you can't, you have to move forward. Okay, major areas for setting objectives. And I simply keep this to a bare minimum. The three areas that I work on are personal, family, and ministry. Personal, family, and ministry. And that personal, I take Luke 2:52 there and decide on one of the areas of Luke 2:52 that I want to work on in particular. Usually I've got two or three of those areas where I'm developing one of those aspects. The family could be on family devotions. It could be prayer time with your wife. In other words, write an objective that's realistic. And don't get all hung up with and all gung-ho about having 20 objectives. Because I know, and you know, that having 20 objectives for one semester will never work. Now, I try, when I sit down in the fall, to think about these major areas for the whole year. I go from September until May. That's how I plan my year. And then, because of the summer training programs, you don't know where you're going to be or what your responsibility will be. You'll have to set some new objectives when you get into there. But I plan and set major objectives in those areas, which are reviewed by the semester. I look at the end of the semester at Christmas time. I sit down, I get out those things, and I have a good hard look and see how realistic they were and where I'm headed and what ones need to be worked on. Okay, how to write objectives. What are the various types? I believe there are three types of objectives that we want to work on, particularly as they pertain to the ministry, and that are they are quantitative, qualitative, and instructional. And I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on this, but a quantitative objective is simply to produce X number of disciple makers by May 1st of 1974. Qualitative would be in the area of character development. A qualitative objective would be, would desire to see the gang in the area really having a deep hunger for the Word of God. That kind of thing is a qualitative. And then an instructional objective might be that you're going to take, say, the doctrine of God, and you're going to impart that to the gang over the semester. Some time on that. I am not going to give you any examples on that. Okay, qualitative, quantitative, and instructional. And where do you begin when you start with objectives? Okay? Well, first of all, and quite obviously, it grows out of time with God. And guys, if you're not spending several days in coming up with your objectives, then you're probably doing an injustice to both yourself and your ministry. I mean, I think it just takes a couple of days to get away, get the heart and the mind cleansed and in gear. A lot of time spent in the Word. You know, just take the whole day and read in the Word of God before you even get your pen out or your pencil out or even begin to think. And it grows out of an extended time with God. You're going to need to get the international and the regional guidelines or objectives. In other words, you cannot set your objectives until you have your boss's objective. Now, that sometimes is very hard to secure around the navigators, is to get your boss's first. He usually likes you to have yours in. But if we were doing this according to good business principles, and for you to do the best job possible, you should actually have at least a guideline of what he's going to be shooting for in his region or in his area, whatever, wherever you fit into that thing. Obviously, the objective must be written. It must be realistic. It should be measurable. And probably, this is where we get into the most difficulty. In other words, the objective, we seem to list a lot of activities rather than objectives. And I realize that some activities can be short-range objectives. But a lot of times, as I look over the guys' objectives, that they, what they really have listed is just a bunch of activities. And so make sure that your objectives are measurable. See, we know when we've produced a disciple maker, don't we? Why? Well, we have a profile. We've got something to measure it against, right? We all work from the same profile. So that's a measurable objective. When you say we're going to produce two or three disciple makers this year, then we know that that's a very measurable objective. Should have some stretch. Little challenge in it. It should be consistent with your responsibility and authority. And by that I mean, if you're assigned to work on one campus, you better stick on that campus until somebody gives you the responsibility and the authority to move into, say, a couple's work or into something else. In other words, don't assume more than what is being asked of you, and move into the, your supervisor, your RD, or whoever is supervising you will know when you're ready for more responsibility. And the tendency is to try and get three or four things going at the same time. And, you know, we all want to get the thing off the ground. We'll have a little collegiate ministry and a couples ministry and so on. Okay, it must be clearly understood by your supervisor. In other words, I hold my guys to their objectives. When I visit the areas, the thing I pull out is their objectives, and we make sure that I clearly understand what they're doing and that they are, in fact, doing what they said that they were going to try to accomplish. And then you are to recommend these to your RD for approval. Now, that's how it should work in a nice business-like fashion. And I realize that sometimes it always doesn't work out that way. But if we were holding to that, and we're in our particular, my particular responsibility, we're moving more and more into this area of being a little more business-like, a little more orderly. Not to put restrictions on guys, but so that we can actually help to measure what is being done and where we're headed. See, objectives are not limiting. They're not a fence that we're trying to build around guys. But they help us to give direction and make sure that we're investing wisely both your time and the finances that people are kicking into this ministry. So don't look at objectives as something that's confining, but rather to give us direction and where we're headed. Okay, a little formula, and probably most of you are familiar with this. You start with the word to, then you have an action verb. Let's see if I can get that up a little bit. Then you state the desired result, the date when it's going to be completed, and a cost not to exceed, so on. Let me just demonstrate that or give you an idea. Let's say in the area of disciples, you'd have something like 2 develop, 10 disciples by June 1st, 1973, at a cost not to exceed my approved budget. Now, I even write these out using this little formula for conferences so that I get an idea of where we're going, what the objectives are, and I use that little formula for almost every little objective that I'm going to write. If I'm going to make a trip to a guy's area, I usually just sketch out in rough a little objective, and I use that formula. And it's consistent, and it'll help you in getting a hold of this whole idea of writing objectives. I don't know about you, but I struggle with this whole idea, and not the idea, but in how to get them so that they're good, so that they're clear, so that they're measurable, and so on. Okay, factors to be considered when you're going to start writing. I'm sorry.
Is this the only object you give for objectives? Is gift direction? Some would say it's motivational thing.
Uh-huh. Oh, I'm sure it is. No, that's not the only object that I have in writing them.
It doesn't seem like when you sit down and write objectives that these are an impetus to the ministry during the year. I mean, that's just the way it seems to come out.
You don't think that it's an impetus?
To me, it doesn't seem to be.
Okay.
Is that the wrong use of making an objective? You're just not using it correctly, or whether it's
okay, now that's a good question. Are objectives an impetus for the ministry throughout the year? In other words, what purpose do they have outside of just giving us direction? That's the question you're asking. How about some of you guys want to speak to that?
Depending on the way you write it, it seems like that you could encode your impetus into the objective so that it verbalizes force that drives you into ministry and also clarifies exactly what you want to see. I see that you wouldn't necessarily have to write it that way, so there could be impetus.
Charlie?
I think it gives impetus in that when you get halfway into it, you kind of get lost in the trees of the forest somewhere and you forget where you're going, and then you've got those objectives that God clearly gave you at the beginning of the year. It can kind of help you keep from getting lost. That's an impetus.
I agree with Charlie. Those objectives are really from God, and you are bogging down somewhere. Go back and look at them. See where God wants you to go. Where are you going right now?
Helps in prayer too, is very specifically.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing is too, if you have involved your key people. And I say this very cautiously because I, looking out over here, I could see that there's a number of guys that are in contact point experience. And so when I say key people, that might be to you a good disciple. But I'm thinking more of disciple makers, guys who are really right-hand men who are carrying a big load in the ministry. If you involve them in the making of your objectives, it will become an impetus. And if you use them periodically to evaluate where you're going. Like when I ran the University of Wisconsin the first year, I wrote the objectives myself, mainly because I only had 13 people to start with, and there was no need to involve them in that Mickey Mouse and so on. It just too time-consuming. I wanted to get on with the job and lead those 13 people onto the campus. But by the time the third year came around, we had 3 men as team leaders who were all really ready to go on a contact point, and each of them had about 50 in their particular responsibility. So I involved the 3 men in the making of the objectives. And the way that you involve them is that they are your resource. They're your your fact-finding people, because they know how many disciples they're going to be able to make in their particular responsibility. You still have to go away and write the objective. And ultimately, the navigators will hold you responsible for it, not your key men out there who helped you write it. But then, what I did every month, we used to meet every single Friday afternoon, we would meet for our team leaders meeting, the three guys and myself. And every month, we would pull out our objectives and our ministry evaluation sheet, which we kept up to date by the month. That is, converts and guys who were making progress and so on. And boy, you talk about a stimulus for us, particularly in the area of prayer. You know, as we would see we're falling behind in this area or we're ahead in this area, it really helped. So how you use your objectives will determine whether it'll be an impetus or just another piece of paper. And that was a good question. Terry?
One thing, well, basically, some people don't like to set down objectives because you have to face those things as either success or failure. Mm-hmm. And by and large, the tendency is looking at the funnel is to start out narrow and end up broadly and not complete them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the normal tendency.
Yeah. I'd say if objectives have one great purpose for me, it's evaluating. It's, I can put that objective against where we are actually in production and in people and so on, and I can see, well, are we going to hit it or are we not? And so it's a great help in that area. Okay, good question. Okay, let's move on a little bit here to other factors to be considered in writing your objectives. Analyzing your analyzing your resources and your opportunities. And I think that your greatest tool, and of course this will only apply to those of you that are working where there was an established ministry, where some guy had filled out a ministry evaluation sheet. That to me was probably the one single thing that helped me the most when I went my first year to the University of Wisconsin, was to pick up the previous man's ministry evaluation sheet and actually take a look at what they had done and who they had left and where we were going. And of course, the ministry evaluation sheet will tell you all kinds of things. It'll tell you strengths. It'll tell you weaknesses. It'll tell you things to work on. And I didn't bring, I had some case studies on various ministry evaluation sheets that I wish I had brought along, but I tore off in such a hurry, I didn't bring them. But you can take a look at a ministry evaluation sheet and tell all kinds of things about ministry. I was talking to a guy today, and I'm sure he won't mind me using the illustration. I won't use his name. But he was telling me that they've had a considerable number of decisions, something like 25 decisions this year so far, which is, you know, that's a pretty active campus ministry. But only 4 are going on. Well, you come to the end of the year, and you fill out your ministry evaluation sheet, and you've got all those converts in that column, and then the ones that are growing Christians. And you start taking a look at things like that and your figures, and they will begin to tell you all kinds of things. For instance, in that particular case, the fellow and I decided that there were probably one of two things. Either his men did not know how to do follow-up, and they needed instruction in that, or they didn't know how to present the gospel properly. And they were making an easy sell or something of that nature. So he's got to go back and analyze the situation, figure out what it is, and work on it. So a ministry evaluation sheet is a tremendous tool, but you know what? The guys don't use them. We don't use them. How often do you pull those things out? How many of you keep them current? You know, like I said, at Wisconsin, when I worked with those three guys, every month we would pull that sheet out, we would add new names to it, make the progresses and so on, and it was a tremendous help to us. Very, very encouraging, and of course gave us a thing to pray about. Okay, other factors to be considered in evaluating before you start to write your objectives, and that is your geography. Believe it or not, that does enter in, I think. And you want to ask yourself questions like, where did we see fruit, the most fruit last year? Okay. Did we invest in an area that did not produce? In other words, did we have a couple of guys working in a particular dormitory and we got absolutely nothing out of it? Then you have to ask yourself the question, why didn't we get anything out of it? Lack of prayer? Lack of know-how? What was the problem? And again, referring back to Wisconsin, we found that there were, at times, God would just bless in a particular dormitory, and we were able to see people come to Christ like crazy. And other dorms where we had men, we were just banging our heads against the wall. So we'd pull the men out of those dormitories and put them into other dormitories where God was working and blessing to move ahead. Go ahead.
Did you analyze whether it was the variable was the wind or the geography? Did the proportion of all of that? The depth of the geography rather than the tiny of the wind?
No, I'd say that probably it was the men. Yeah. It was a hard place. The dorms I'm referring to were very hard. They were the ones closest to the downtown section. They were the ones where the kids who had the most money went there. And they were, you know, so it was tough. But I think, you know, if the man is creative and innovative, that God will bless him in most cases. And I'd say, looking back on it now, it's a combination. You know, tough geography, but also probably inexperienced men. Now, these are only factors, guys, to put into the hopper. Okay? You add them to the hopper so that as you're... What new places should we hit? And I just put that little one in there on fraternities. And I hope you guys are hitting into these fraternities and really not conceding anything to the enemy, because there are some good men. If you want if you want to get some good time with a guy who's doing quite an extensive work in fraternities, Dave Gross at KSU is they're really into fraternities, and they're bagging some good men. Boy, they're really pulling them out. And up until the last couple of years, it's been pretty hard to get guys out of the fraternities, but they figured out how to work around it. And not pull the men out of the fraternities, but leave them in there so that they can really turn on other guys. And you have to be able to allow for that in your activities and so on, because the guys in fraternities are oversubscribed in their extracurricular activities, but we can work around that. Okay, new resources available. And a couple of these new resources would be men who are returning that are better trained. Men who are returning who are better trained. They've been off to a summer training program and they're coming back. They are they're a better resource than they were when they left. And then, of course, we all get some new people transferred in, some guys coming out of the military into the collegiate, some guys that will just transfer in who have graduated at another school to do some grad work, or some guys just to pull in alongside of the rep. These are all factors to be taken into consideration. Basic principle: take your best resources and apply it to your best opportunity. Is that blackboard in your way? Probably not. I think it turns off there. Take your best resources and plant them in your best opportunity. And by that I mean, if you've got a good man and a good dorm, put the two together and you'll have a red hot combination. Okay, something else to take into consideration when you're writing your objectives is that I think you should be a prophet. Be a prophet. I think you ought to figure out from your boss how long you're going to be there. Get an idea when you're going into your situation just how long you're going to be there, and try and be a prophet down the road. If I were taking my first assignment right now with the Navigators and I were going back to the University of Wisconsin, the thing I would ask myself is, Bob, what do you really want to see God accomplish here on this campus over the next 3 years? When you left here at the end of 3 years, what would you like to see left in terms of disciple makers and people who love Christ and so on, and couples and every other aspect that you can think of in the ministry? And it takes a little bit of vision, and I think we need that. It seems like we operate, you know, from semester to semester, or at the best for 1 year. But try and take a look down the road as, you know, if you know you're going to be there for a couple of years, well, what do you really want to see God accomplish through your life over the next couple of years? Be a prophet. Write out your objectives by stating the results expected. Plan for 1 year. Plan for one semester. In other words, you work back from your three-year plan. Always stating your objectives and results expected, and then you plan for 1 year, and then you have a plan for a semester. So you have a long-range plan. It's almost like the corporation objectives that Sandy has just come up with. They plan for 3 years. But then we also have to work those back into the nitty-gritty and back into the 1 year and the one semester. Now, here's an example of how to plan for 3 years. It's really a loose example, but it'll give you an idea of what I mean. First year, develop a broad base. And by a broad base, guys, I mean a broad base. Boy, if there's a weakness I see as I travel around from area to area, that is that we are not broad at the base. We are so anxious to do man-to-man with people that we grab the first walking bodies that go by, and we limit ourselves so much, rather than working on a broad base, a huge base, and seeing those good men begin to rise out of that, and in investing our lives in those guys. The tendency is, when you first go out there, you're so anxious to succeed, and so anxious to have somebody to work with, that you beg the first guy that comes along, and you know, it takes you 6 months to discover that he hasn't got assurance. And you've invested 6 months of life, of your life, into his life. And so in that first year, and particularly in the first semester, the broad base is a must. If you don't make it in the first semester of every school year in terms of getting a huge broad base, you're just behind the eight ball for the whole year. You're just working uphill for the whole year. Dan?
Could you define that more? Are you thinking in terms of non-Christian friends?
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. I'll just break it down even more more definitive than that, Dan. What I do when I go and visit the guys now is I have them get their ministry team together. And, you know, you go to some campuses, they got 25, 30 people on the ministry team. Boy, that's great. Tremendous. Well, how many people you got in Bible study? For, you know, so they do a quick figure, and they got 100 people in Bible study. Well, or maybe 150, which is pretty good, but it's not really that much. When you break down 25 people into 150, that's not a very good ratio. And I have a little figure of 10. I like to see a guy have 5 non-Christian contacts and 5 Christian contacts, so that the 25 now become 250. Now that's the bare minimum broad base. But that's what I'm talking about. It's just the number of contacts. It's the number of people that you can beg to come to a rally, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, and that base is very important. And I think for disciples and above, 10 is a bare minimum. I mean, good night. You get 10 people on the floor in the dormitory that you ought to be on it. You know, if the guys are really doing their job and really, really love the Lord, 10 people is not that many. We just need to push. I think we need to push people. And okay, then the second year you'd work on developing your disciples, and in the third year you would begin to really capitalize on 2 or 3 men who are reproducers, DMs. And that's just a very sketchy example, but that's what I mean by being a prophet, planning 2 or 3 years down the road. John?
On your broad-based Bible, you hit certain campuses where it was more difficult to get guys in Bible study than others, which these might have to kind of broad-based in terms of non-Christian friends or something like that. Are you strictly with getting back Bible study?
Well, yeah, I guess there are some campuses that are notoriously tough, but boy, you take the University of Wisconsin, that's not exactly it's a radical school. And we had no problem. But we were out there hitting it. We had an aggressive approach to evangelism as well as the evangelistic Bible studies and Bible study in particular. And I think if we're praying and believing God that, sure, it's tough, but there are people out there that we know are interested. And I would say, and I was talking to Bob Hall about this a little earlier in the day, the thing we need to do, see, we work real hard on getting people effective in evangelism. That is, we teach them how to present the arrow or the bridge or whatever you're using. And we work pretty good on polishing that. We take them out and correct them and help them and so on. But how many of us give guys instruction in how to recruit for Bible studies? You know, have you ever taken the guys out onto a floor and said, here, look, I'll show you how to get a Bible study going. And take them out on the floor and get a Bible study going and then take them through one. Well, we've got to pace that in that, guys. Because if we can't do it, they can't do it. And we've got to be able to go over there and do that. And I would say the I'm sure you're aware of this one, but I love to use this one. That there are two people on most floors, if your dorm setup is the same as what I'm familiar with, there are two people on the floors that are very influential. And that is the house president and the social chairman. And when I go onto a guy's floor and I want to start a Bible study, that's the two places I head for. I go to the first open door and I introduce myself and I say, hey, who's your house president and where is the social chairman located? Then I go right down to that room and say, hey, I'm with the Navigators. We're an interdenominational organization working here on the campus, and we're interested in getting some guys into a discussion on the person of Jesus Christ and whether he's relevant to today or not. And we thought we'd stop in here and get this thing set up on this floor, and what do you suggest? And you throw the ball to him. Now, if he's a social chairman, he's looking for programs anyways. I mean, that's his job, is to look for deals. And he'll have all kinds of suggestions. And the best deal is if you can get him, say, okay, look, we want to set this thing up for the next 3 weeks, 1 hour a night, Tuesday nights. We'll come over here at 8 o'clock, and we'll have a one-hour wrap, and we'll use your room, okay? Great, okay. So you go over at 7:30. You go into his room, hey, man, you all ready for the wrap? Oh, boy, I haven't given too much thought to it. Well, that's okay. Let's go round up the guys. And he'll say, okay, I know every guy on the floor who needs this kind of discussion. See, and he knows. So work off of the president and the social chairman. I mean, they're winners. Either the guy was absent from the meeting where he got elected, or he does have some kind of charisma that attracts people. But see, I think a lot of times, you know, we go onto the floor and we look for that single guy, one guy in a room, and he's kind of a lone rabbit anyways, and, you know, we all gang up on him. And all I'm saying is let's blow our minds and really go after this thing and go after it aggressively. And go after the guys that have got some leadership ability, and we're not just after them, but they're good inroads into the rest of the dormitory. So they're and see, we need to teach our guys how to do that, and so you guys need to go out and do it too.
Let's throw your plan that you have as an example. Did you have in mind primarily a guy that was strong ministry, or a guy that was kind of replacing? Who's already started might have a broad base.
Yeah. Well, you'll have to pick up and plug in where you are. In other words, I was thinking more on a guy going in and he's just starting from scratch. Basically starting. He might have 5 contacts there or something like that, but where you're going in to really crank one up and you know you're going to be there for 3 years. And again, all I'm trying to do is give you an idea of the progression in the thing, because every year you're going to work on the broad base, except that you in particular will major on the disciples the second year. And in the third year, you'll major on the disciple makers. But the whole gang will always work toward the broad base. You can never stop the broad base principle. As soon as you stop that, then about 1 year down the road, you find out you got nothing left. You know, it dries up. So the base has always got to be expanding. We've got to push and push and push.
Could you draw my imagination with a couple more ideas?
On evangelistic studies, broad and base? Well, Andrews will get into this on the last day, so I'll leave that for him. I'll steal some of his thunder if I get into that, but he'll blow your mind with a few good ideas. Okay, let's move on a little bit here. Okay, that's the first step, planning and setting your objectives. There are the factors to be considered and the things you want to take into consideration. And once you've got your objective written out, then you come to this whole area of personnel, organizing your personnel, organizing that which you have into some kind of form. Okay, organizing your personnel. And I, again, this is not the end all, and I would recommend all you guys, so that you never get in a rut. I didn't bring the book. You know, this whole idea of man-to-man and disciple-making and so on, it can tend to stifle if you're not very careful. And Gardner's book on... somebody help me. No, the other one. What was the other one?
Self-renewal.
Boy, he really is very strong in this whole idea that don't let these things strangle you, but use them to expand and be innovative. And so all I'm sharing is some things that have worked for me, but for goodness sakes, be innovative. Feel free to, you know, try new things and try different things. But these are some of the things that I've found that work, and so I'll share them with you. In organizing your personnel, I usually go into three teams. I have the multitude, which I call the area team, and that's what Jesus had. It's just kind of the total bunch. People who are in Bible study, people who are, they just like the Navigator ministry, they might only come to rallies, that kind of thing. And it's just the big bunch. And that's the area team. And people like to belong. So let them know that they belong. You know, they're the Navigator gang. And they're on the area team. Boy, there's no problem with that. They belong. And then I go into what I call the ministry team, which we could consider the 12, although most ministry teams that I am familiar with in our territory far exceed the 12. I'm not sure that that's always good as far as the training is concerned. But let's call that the ministry team. And they're the ones that carry the bulk of the workload. They're kind of, as Lauren would say, they're the bell cows. They're the leaders. Okay? They're the ones out there and people are following. Okay? That's... And in a core, some kind of a core team, and it could be three or four people. And I found in running a one-campus ministry that probably four people, if I wanted to keep involved in the grassroots and do follow-up and discipling, three or four disciple-makers was all I could handle. Now, if you want to get out of the ministry and just work with disciple-makers, then you could probably handle six or seven, maybe even eight. But that is one of the things I look for when I come visit every guy's area. Has he organized himself out of the ministry? And in most cases, there is a very distinct tendency to organize himself out of the ministry because there are people there that he feels, and particularly when you go in and adopt somebody else's area, there are people around there that he feels obligated to work with and give time to, and so he finds himself consumed with 10 or 12 people because he brought four in, and the guy that was there left eight, you know, so he's got 10 or 12 people that he feels obligated to. And pretty soon he's spending all of his time just ministering to that bunch, not developing any new fruit. And one of the things that I worked at the University of Wisconsin again was to stay active in follow-up and discipling. So that as I'm ministering to my three men on Friday afternoons, I can say, well, here's what I'm doing with old Jim Wright. Boy, I'm doing this and this and this. And those guys knew it because they could see Jim growing and developing and so on. So stay active. Somebody had a hand up. Okay. Standards for these different teams. These are pretty loose and just some guidelines. But for the area team, it's just people who they're open to help. You know, they want to come around. They want to be ministered to at the rally. It's a very loose type of involvement and doesn't demand a whole lot. They choose their particular involvement. They want to be in on a weekly Bible study, fine. They just want to come to rallies, fine. But that's kind of the bunch, the mooing herd. And in the ministry team, we have some distinct and a little more clearly define standards. And before I invite a person onto the ministry team, I would want to have seen them in Bible study for at least a year. That is a consistent, regular Navigator Bible study, or the equivalent, for 1 year before I'll invite them onto the ministry team. Gang, there's a tendency to lay hands suddenly on good, sharp, young people. And I have seen casualty after casualty of good guys who have really wiped out because we laid hands too soon. We got them involved in a very active ministry too soon. And that somehow we overlooked their growth and development in loving Jesus. So that's why I have this little, and you can put in your own guideline as to the length of time. But let's let these young people, these young recruits, get their feet down and get anchored in Christ, rooted and grounded and built up in Christ first. You know, we have lots of time to teach them the ministry. In fact, we got people coming out of college now that we've given 3 or 4 years to. And what are we going to teach them from here on? I mean, man, they end up at college and they've done as much in the ministry as most of us have done. You know, we teach them everything. We cram it into. We got nothing left for them except to make them staff and send them out. And they're young, too young. There's no maturity. So we got lots of time to teach them the ministry, and we can teach them the ministry after they graduate. There's no problem in that. Let them get anchored and deep in Christ. I'm not saying it's a balance is what I'm aiming for there. Okay, they need to be giving to the area, and I realize that there might be some different attitudes on that, but before they come on the ministry team, they need to be giving regularly to the area. They're establishing themselves in the wheel, and the key word there is that they are establishing themselves in the wheel. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're, they've got that thing in perfect operation, but that they're pretty well squared away and they're establishing themselves. They identify on their own. That is, that they're not afraid when the opportunity presents itself in an English class to identify with Christ, they'll go ahead and identify with Christ and in some way, shape, or form. And this is probably the most important one, or one of them, is that they're committed to receiving training. And I sit down with these people and that we invite on the ministry team, and I outline what it's going to cost them in terms of involvement. So that when they, because the NAVs have got a real appeal to people, the in-group and that kind of thing. And so we get a lot of people that want to get in on that ministry team, and then they get in, and all of a sudden they realize it costs them 5 nights a week plus weekends. And boy, they weren't really ready for that. So I make sure that I sit down and I go over that and I spell out what it really is going to mean in terms of involvement. And that is very important. In fact, it's a lordship issue with a lot of people. And then lastly, they're invited onto that team by the rep or the core team member if you so want to delegate it to the core team guy to do the inviting. In other words, it's a very, it's kind of a formal, I make it a rather formal thing. And I do it at the beginning of the semester or at the end of the semester, never in between. In other words, we don't just kind of have an open door policy, but if one of the guys on the core team comes to me and says, hey, old Charlie, he's ready to be invited on the ministry team, I'll say, well, that's fine. Let's wait till semester break, and then we'll add him on the team at that time. In other words, we make a little formal initiation type thing so that there's a little cutting edge to it, and it's not just an open door type thing where they can run in and run out any way they want.
Do you find that helps build a spirit of core among the ones that are already in
the... Yes. Yeah, it's a sense of that this thing is not a Mickey Mouse type operation, and that we mean business. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. You bet. That's why he's been around for a year before he gets invited. Weren't what? Yeah. Oh boy. They go over and get sick in the corner. Well, the best I can say is you ride it out. It's a very painful thing, both for them and for you, to try and cut the guy out at that particular point, particularly if he doesn't want to be cut out, and yet he doesn't have the equipment to carry on. So all you can do, John, is kind of nurse the thing through and band-aid it and help it the best you can, and then change it at the semester. Or see, I always hold the prerogative to change every semester. And so the whole gang knows that we reorganized every semester. And if I want to make changes at that particular point, then I can make changes. If I decide we want to go this direction, we can go in this direction. And I always hold that prerogative. So nothing is beyond the semester. In other words, if I have a guy on the ministry team. Now, I don't want to create a feeling of insecurity there. So they know that once they're usually invited on the ministry team, they're there for the duration. But in that case, you could probably ease a guy off at that particular point. But you've got to really be careful, because you can really hurt a guy. You really hurt his relationship with the Lord. I don't care diddly squat about his ministry, but his relationship with the Lord really does count. And so I'd rather leave him on if it meant harming his relationship with the Lord. Yes. It's hard. That inheritance business is really hard, you know, because personalities are involved. And the previous guy, I mean, he liked these guys. Like Sandy says, who does Sandy have on his team? Well, one qualification is people he likes. That's his one distinct quality. Just people I like, you know. Well, you know, let's face it. It's a spiritual thing to think that we can work with everybody and so on and so forth. But let's face it. Personalities are involved. So when you inherit, you've got to kind of go. The first year of your inheritance is kind of a touch and go thing in terms of getting the people behind you, winning hearts, and so on, and so forth. And I think personally, when you inherit, take the whole ball of wax and say, "Great gang, let's go," and just get out there and run. Don't organize any teams, but just take off. Say, "Man, this is where we're going. We're going to hit in this particular dormitory, and we're going to do this and this and this and just." Just run, and then look back about the end of 2 months. Look back, you know, go out there about 3 or 4 nights a week, and just lead those people out, and then look back to see what you got left, and see who's following, and then you'll be able to form your teams and so on.
Is it possible to outrun a guy like that? Putting pressure on, start moving faster and faster until he just realizes
it's helping people. Yes. Yeah. In fact, that might be one of the objectives. It might be a little way you can sort it out without you having to get involved and say, "Well, you don't have the, you know, you don't have the ability to run as fast as I'm going to run for this year." And so it can be an easy way, and you can sit down with the guy after a while and say, "Now look, well, we've been at this thing for 2 months, and instead of coming out 3 nights a week, you only come 1 night a week, and I'm looking for some guys who can give me 3 nights a week. Now I'm happy with your 1 night a week." But let me put you on this team until you're ready for 3 nights a week, and or whatever it is that you operate on, 5 nights a week or 6 nights a week. Yeah. Okay, core team, there's a couple of verses there. Jesus was very select. That Luke 14 passage I really like. When people say, "Well, Jesus didn't select," not much. Luke 14, boy, he really lays it open. In 25, he speaks to the multitude. He turns and says to the multitude, "You cannot be my disciple unless you do this and this and this and this and this." And boy, that's if that isn't selection, what is, you know? And so the core team, he's with you in heart. He is with you in heart. See, you can't... I've made the mistake of adding guys on the core team to win their hearts. Bad deal. Bad. I've made the mistake of inviting people to live in my home to win their hearts. And that is even a worse deal. Boy, I'll tell you, my wife and I could give you pain and pain upon pain just talking about that. He's got to be with you in heart. He's your buddy, and he's with you in heart. Boy, I'm with you. He's committed to the NAV vision. Now, not the NAV organization. I said the NAV vision, and that's important. He's living a Christ-centered, disciplined life. And that differs, of course, from the ministry team where I said he's establishing himself in the wheel. This guy on the core team is living a Christ-centered, disciplined life. He's fruitful. And he is totally available. Now, again, guys, these are just some guidelines, some things that I use in forming the little teams in my area. And they've helped me over the past years to identify and the various levels, where men are, where to plug them in, where to help them best. And again, it is not it's not meant to be confining. It's meant to be a little guide. And it also helps me to evaluate the kind of men. So I can see, well, does this guy really meet all this criteria? And if he does, then I can invite him on. And go ahead, Bob. He's leading people to Christ. Yeah, see, when you put a person on your core team, he's supposedly, I don't know what you call him, but most people are using the term team leader. Well, to me, a team leader has got to have people who follow him. Not people that I gave him to organize, but people who follow him. And boy, if there's another thing that I see as I go from campus to campus, is guys that are team leaders that have never, you know, in some cases they've led some people to Christ but never seen anybody go on and follow up. And yet they're a team leader for the sake of organization. For the sake of organization, we call them a team leader. We put them over here. You know, we need somebody to run that dorm and be responsible for it. Man, I visited a campus recently. There's this little wee gal, a little wee slip of a thing, 2.5 years around the navigators. And she's carrying around a dormitory on her back. I said, well, have you ever led anybody to Christ? Who's going on? She said, no. I said, well, is anybody following you? No. Well, how in the world did you get the title team leader? And she gets to go to all those meetings, got to get in on all the objectives and all. Boy, let people love Jesus and develop some fruit. Just get out there and do some evangelism and lead some people to Christ. And let team leaders develop naturally. Now, I believe that you can import a person as a team leader, if they've demonstrated on the previous place. But our problem is we move people around so fast they never get a chance to demonstrate. So let's make sure that they are really team leaders. Paul?
So in other words, this is an added thing that you have a ministry team, the necessity of a big team. In other words, you're not just trying to set up a ministry team.
Right. Man, if you don't need it, don't have it. In other words, we don't organize at this level until we got a lot of bods around and we need to. We're forced into it. No, it's not. See, most guys go to a campus now, and because we teach them all this good stuff on objective setting and everything, they go and they figure out, well, now let's see, there is a nice geographic area, and there's one, and there's one, and I need a team leader here, and here, and here. And so they take, you know, the bods that are available, and they, well, run with it as one big group until you're forced into organizing. Okay, any more? There were some hands back.
Could you discuss any of the methods you mentioned on these initial Bible studies or teaching people to get a Bible study going? What type of studies did you use?
Okay. And Al Andrews will touch on that again, but let me say this. One of the things that's really hard is to teach a guy how to use Book 1 as a Bible study tool. That's a very hard, I mean, you can do it, but it's really hard. And I prefer to, for broadening the base and just getting some contacts, I prefer to use a discussion type approach. That is, like, I'll take the Gospel of John, take the first, take four chapters out of there, take a certain number of verses each night for 1 hour, just read 10 verses or whatever it is, and have about 3 or 4 good discussion questions and just have a wide open wrap. And let them, see, guys don't want to come to a Bible study and fill out a blank and be restricted. What they want to come is they want to come and argue their philosophy. And we owe them that. Good night, you want to argue yours, don't you? And we owe them. See, we're so afraid of being shot out of the saddle, so we go with Book 1. And we'll answer that question later. Or, you know, I'll get to that one later. We don't even let them, you know, ask questions that take us off the track. And that's dumb. Because how are we ever going to get to the issues that they're really struggling with? So I like the discussion approach, just a wide open 1 hour, you know, for 3 weeks running. Then I go back and contact each guy individually, maybe share the bridge with them, maybe not, but then invite them into a more formal type Bible study. So they've had a transition. They don't go right to that little book which kind of turns them off. See, it's another course, and they didn't really want another course. You know, they're already loaded up to the hilt with courses and so on. We have a question back here.
Is it possible still to use the book one where they fill it out and you don't even cover it, but just cover questions that you understand?
Oh, yeah. You can use any approach you want. I'm just saying for me personally, I don't like the book one approach. But that's me. You know, I just kind of a rebel, and I don't like that particular. At that point, my first contact, my first few Bible studies. Yes.
What level was
it? Oh, he was about a D. Oh, let's see. You don't use that terminology. He'd be about in yes, you do. D2. About the middle of discipleship.
Would you consider
Oh, if he's sharp and can handle it, yeah. Yeah, you. You know, he's got to be a guy who can think, and it depends on his background in the Bible, too. I mean, the guy does need to be able to answer some of the questions. But see, I never conclude. In those studies, I never come to a conclusion. I leave it wide open and just let them argue and fight and scream and yell at one another. And I mean, that's the idea. But I always leave them with enough that they know that I've got something they don't have.
Is there any optimum size, like 10 people?
That's probably too many. I think for good, I like about 4 to 6, somewhere in there. But again, it's up to the, you know, some of you guys are more gifted in leading Bible studies and some less, and so you got to figure out what you like to do best. Where I trained the guy, we did it with one guy, and it was really fun. Where I threw was the two of us and one other guy, and we didn't have a chance. So.
Were you talking about maybe you do camp 50 or 100 students?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Say you're on a big campus and you raise a lot of people, you want to go into this kind of discussion type study. You said you have 4 to 8.
That is the ones that you would lead. Yeah, one study, 4 to 8 people. New people in a study.
So they would take a lot of leadership.
Yeah. But you might not see, you don't need to do it with all your people. The best tool that we have, or one of it's kind of a paradox. The best tool we have in helping people lead Bible studies is the book series, 1 through 10. So when a guy is first beginning, for him to learn to lead a Bible study with book 1, that's good. Because it's easy and, you know, he just needs to follow along, use his head a little bit, and he's got a little thing. So you take your more mature guys, we ought to have people on this core team particularly who know how to lead 3 or 4 different types of Bible studies. The best study that I have come across of this type is one that Ivy put out. It's called Discussions on the Life of Christ. And boy, it is excellent. It's just a little 35-cent booklet, and it is a winner. White House put me onto it when I went to Madison, and boy, it really helped me. Discussions on the Life of Christ by University Press. Let's go on here a little bit, and let's see. Yeah, I can cover the last part of this thing, and then we'll just open it up for questions at that point. Still sticking with this theme of personnel. When you ask people to commit themselves to you, you ought to be willing to give them a commitment. And this really helped. Dave Gross was sharing with me the first part of the year when I got onto this thing with them about having some standards for teams and how to invite guys on the team and that kind of thing. And then he went one step further and he wrote out his commitment to them so that when he sat down and shared with these people what it was going to cost them, then he wrote out what his commitment to them was. And I thought this was rather helpful. And basically it's to help them walk with God. Buddy, if you come on this ministry team, I will personally ensure that you get the help that you need to develop your relationship with God. I might not do it personally, but I will make sure that you get the help that you need to grow. And if it means that I've got to do it personally, then I'll make sure that I'm going to train you in your life and in your ministry. I'm going to help you in your life and in your ministry. And then finally, I am totally available to you. You ask them for total availability, you better be willing to be totally available to them. And so just, you can express your commitment to them. You might want to get into a little more detail on that with them and make it a little more, a little broader than that, and that's fine. But that'll give you an idea. See, I think we we owe them something. It's too one way when we invite them on and we're going to do this to accomplish this objective. You better have a personal commitment to them too.
Now, is them the team members or the core
team? Both, ministry team and the core team.
All ministry team members.
Yep, I'm available to them. No, I'm not available to them like I am to the core team guys. But if they got a problem, well, I want it, and they want to pick up the phone and call me and come over for you. Bet I'll work them in anytime.
Do you try to do that on an individual basis or in the context?
Probably in the group. When I pull the whole team together and we're going over the stuff in the fall, I'd probably run over that with the ministry team. Now, with the core team, I'd go over it individually because they know it by then anyways, but I want to articulate it. Any other questions? Here are a few problems in organizing your personnel, and I think we've touched on most of these. Too many on the core team. Too many on the core team. And you just simply, the more you have on your core team, the less you do at the grassroots. And you are the good seed, and you ought to be out there in the grassroots. So, you know, I don't know what the optimum is on that, but I sure don't think it would be any more than six on a core team where you're going to really minister to them in any kind of depth. In fact, it's the rare bird that can minister to six guys in depth and still get out there and hit it in the grass. You organize yourself out of the ministry. That is that you give, you delegate the dormitories to the various men, and you're just not out there hitting it and leading the guys out in the ministry. And tomorrow I'll get into a little more on this from Scripture on pace setting and the whole idea. And then, of course, another problem which was already touched on in organizing your personnel is you get the wrong people on certain teams. And I really don't have any concrete one answer for this because you can't give one answer. You have to take the individual situation and analyze it and figure out how to help the person out of that situation and so on. So there's no pat answer for that. It depends on the guy or the gal. And so on. Team leaders who are not qualified. And I think a team leader, personally, should have been around at least 2 years, must have fruit, and I prefer them to be a disciple maker. That would be the bare minimum for a team leader. Okay, it's almost quarter after, so let's just open it up for some more questions. And
when you say a team leader needs to be around for 2 years, does that mean around you?
Yeah, unless it's a guy coming in from another area, you know, a qualified man coming in from another area. But I'm thinking of a person who grows up in the grassroots ministry there. They should have been around at least 2 years before I'm going to give them a dormitory.
How long would you have somebody else coming in around you, though? Say, you know, he's been recommended, but...
Okay. It depends on who recommends them. It comes down to this this individual thing, and we all evaluate differently. So what I do when I'm going to get a new guy in an area is I make no commitment as to what he's going to do, but I bring him into the area, and I just let him run in the area. Now, I might say, go over to this dorm complex, and there are these guys over there, and kind of... Old Charlie kind of heads that up. Now you just go on over. I know he's a better man than Old Charlie. But I just tell him, go over there and run with those guys. Do evangelism with them, so on. And I just kind of wait for a month or maybe even 2 months. And let the gang get the feel of him. And let him get a feel for the gang. Then I can officially lay hands on him and pour oil or whatever you want to do, whatever ceremony you use, and make him a team leader. But that will really help you. It will keep you it'll keep you from getting burned. Because if he doesn't have the, you know, if he's not as sharp as old Charlie's going to have some problems. Not only in his heart, which is really Charlie's problem, we can teach him to get over that, but you squelch his development, Charlie's, if you bring a guy in over top of him who can't help him. Boy, you don't help old Charlie. And so be careful when you bring a guy in like that. Just go slow.
Charlie's.
I don't even tell them that. I just say, you go on over there with Charlie's guys and we're that complex. Don't tell them too much because you want to figure out whether he'll go over there and say, follow me. Woom. Then you know you got a team leader. No problem, you see. if he can figure that out that fast. But most guys will come in and they don't know you and they're kind of feeling their way and they'll kind of tread softly. But if he goes over and organizes the whole dormitory, I don't have any problems with that. Then I know I got a team leader.
Is Charlie a team leader?
No. At that point, Charlie is not a team leader. No. He's the key guy. He's the guy that when you're going to have the guys come over Saturday morning, you would call Charlie and Charlie go round them all up and bring them over Saturday morning. Okay, Bo?
This may sound like an obvious, stupid question. What would you do? Let's say you're going to be the campus director for the next 10 years. And have you told you that for the next 10 years you're responsible for the University of Wisconsin? Well, what would be your objective?
Well, okay. I'm not hedging on it because it's not a loaded question, but it depends on my gifts and abilities. See, I think some of you guys are going to be navigator rep makers. You're going to be able to make some staff men. Now, goodness, that is not the ultimate. And any guy that shoots for that has a very limited vision. But there are some of you guys that are going to be better at that than other guys. But then there are also other of you that are very strong in evangelism. And so it would depend on what my gift and ability would be. And if you're personally asking me, I think it would be in terms of the number of navigator staff that I could produce off that. That's the thing that I feel, the contribution I can make to the navigators.
Yeah, I think I was thinking more of a man who wasn't a rep maker, but a great gift.
Yeah. Well, if I knew I was going to be there 10 years, boy, it'd be the whole city. Yeah, you bet. The whole schmear from top to bottom. And in 10 years, you could do it. You'd have a pretty good, you could really crank one up in 10 years, couldn't you?
Well, the other day you were sharing with me about working in ministry. Could you expound on that a little bit, what you mean by working and how that
I'm not sure of the conversation we had. Was it in regards to working a regular secular job?
No, I'm just really working at it rather than just doing it. What do you mean by working as a minister?
Rod, I can't recall the conversation. I'm a blank on the conversation. Were we drinking that night? Or? We probably had one too many. Well, I think, it's coming back now. You know, there's an attitude, and I want to say this gently and cautiously, but there's an attitude of just, we're in the family, and the navigator family, and we're on the staff, and we go through the motions of the ministry, and a guy can keep a pretty good ministry going by just, not putting a whole lot of effort into it. But, I'm looking for some tigers. And when I go around and visit, that's what I like to instill in guys. I came in the other day and Walt was fixing the fireplace. I said, Walt, is that one of your jobs? He turned around and very quickly said, yep, that's my job. Go around lighting fires in the right places. And that's the kind of thing, to light the right fire in the right place. And our attitude toward the ministry, boy, keep yourself motivated in the ministry. I mean, super motivated in the ministry. Take that time alone with God, and see, because God gives you the motivation. That time in the Word will really, and take those one day a month, at least, and get alone with God, and get in that book, and keep your motivation running hot. Not cool or lukewarm, but running hot. Guys, and when you're in the ministry, really hit it. Really work at it. And give it all you got. You know, it's not a 40-hour a week job, it's a life. Period. From beginning to end, and we're in this thing to the end, And so let's really get at it. And forget the casual approach to it. There are no summers off in the Navigators. And, let's get at it. Man, IBM, they give you 2 weeks off to get married, your holidays, and that kind of thing. We got a good deal going in Navigators. Let's not blow it. Let's hit it when we can.
Can you, just from your own experience, recount a time in which you find the motivation going down and then tell us what was the problem and what you did to solve it?
I would say in the last 2 years, since I moved into the RD job and so on, that the thing that the tendency is, because you're not totally immersed in the people, you're not always involved with people, your motivation will go down. And two things you need to do to keep your motivation up. And there, besides the regular basics and so on. But evangelism and building a few disciples. Boy, I'm sorry, it's not profound or anything. But see, I pray, last year when I had Kansas, Missouri, and Illinois, I prayed that God would give me fruit on every campus that I visited. And I think God, as far as I know, on every campus, God gave us fruit through my preaching and so on. And so I'm involved in evangelism, same as you are. I never get out of that, even though I travel. And this year, same thing. Boy, I'm going up to visit Klingman. I said, hey, look, I don't care what else we do, but just get me a dormitory meeting of some kind so I can preach the fiery gospel and stay involved. That's the thing that, besides my developing my relationship with the Lord, evangelism and making disciples. See, investing your life in the lives of others. And, that's the thing that turns me on, Dan. And when I'm running down, it's usually where I'm having some problems or maybe I'm just not investing my life in the right people, that kind of thing. Or I'm out of evangelism, where I'm not evangelizing. Man, I had a blast last week. We skied up at Taos last week, and they got the longest ski run, chairlift, one of the longest. Well, it's the longest one I've ever been on. I haven't been on too many. But you talk about a good place to witness. I mean, the guy can't get off. And so that was delightful just to be able to do that and, share Christ. So just stay involved, Keep doing it. Go ahead, young whippersnapper.
My impression from all that you said so far is that it seems quite a rigid and structured to me. And I wonder in my own mind where fitting a guy's individual, unique spiritual needs fits into this system. Maybe he meets all those standards, but it wouldn't meet his needs to be a team leader.
Well, right.
And he doesn't have a conviction about one of those areas because of lack of information or something.
Well, that's the thing that you want to discuss with them. See, you are headed in a certain direction with that Navigator bunch, right? Now, if you've got a guy that's outside of that, then you've got to figure out, do you want to make an exception? And if he's the kind of guy that you're trying to describe, yes, you do want to make an exception. But you don't let too many people know that you've made the exception. I mean, let's face it. Boy, if I've got a horse, just because he doesn't run the same track that I do, I am going to get that bird. No matter how. And so, right, we don't want to stifle or kill for the sake of having... All this does is give you a guideline as to the direction you want to head and where to fit people in. But when you got one of those studs that doesn't fit into that, man, just figure out how to fit them in. Even if you got to have him on your own private individual team over here on the left. I'll make an exception for the right kind of guy. If God gives me you've got to get it from the Lord. Luke 6, 11, 12, and 13, you go up on the mountain and pray and ask God who he wants you to invest your life with. But also, you can't carry many guys like that. If you get too many, because they'll rip you apart in your heart more than anything. When you get guys that are running off in every direction and you're trying to keep that thing together, boy, it just tears you out. If you've got something on your heart and you're trying to head down this line. My wife and I really went through some struggles with some guys we had living with us. And they were the core team. They were the bunch. They were the bell cows and everything else. But they were also a pretty hard bunch to get a hold of. And we made some real mistakes on that stuff. So I'm pretty standardized and the kind of guys I want to invite on. But I'll make exception if it warrants it.
Bob, did you find it frustrating to constantly be uprooted and have to start over again?
Uh-huh.
Being able to see something really build up where you wanted it?
Yeah, I would say that hopefully we're getting to the place in the Navigators, particularly in the collegiate ministry, where we will not need to uproot guys as quickly as what we have in the past. For instance, in the Northern Division now, the standard contact point is 3 years. And I'm sure that that's the same in the other divisions. At least I think it's an international guideline. But it really hasn't been adhered to in too many divisions, and particularly in the Northern Division. We've moved guys around rather quickly, and so we're trying to get a little more. See, it takes 3 years, doesn't it? At least to really to see some of those guys come up to disciple maker, it takes 3 years. Let's not kid ourselves. You know, or they might meet the profile, you know, by the skin of their teeth and so on. But I mean, where they're really qualified people, it takes a bare minimum of 3 years. Let's face it, probably 5 years if we're being realistic. So I'd like to see us extend that time and give you guys more opportunity. However, as you know, there are needs and people are sent overseas, and that's not going to change. It's not going to get lessen up any. But
have you taken any study on the kind of Jews, Catholics, Protestants that are becoming disciples? Also, anybody in heaven is working, having good work with Jews?
No, I have no idea. Rod's working with some at Northwestern University in Chicago, but you might want to put your head together with him.
I just wondered if the majority of Protestants would come to the disciples, or whether they came to the
I don't know. Bo, do you have?
Yeah, I know. Billy Graham, talking to John Quartz, which would they follow up with him. He said that they have their highest percentage of people that belong to the Catholics.
Is that right? Isn't that something? Well, that's interesting. Tremendously. John?
I'll go with another question. You mentioned fraternities and making exceptions, you know, kind of hard time to schedule leading guys in the fraternities. Have you, what about athletes?
Same thing. Oh, good night. Don't pull those jocks out of that, you know. Man, those guys are going to have tremendous influence. And, boy, leave them in there. You know, Dave Zink at the University of Wisconsin was on the varsity basketball team, and boy, if we'd ever hacked him out of that thing, that would have been cutting off our nose. He had tremendous ministry while he was there. He's got guys that are still coming out of there, and he hasn't been there for 2 years. I mean, that are great, great, great grandchildren type thing. And
did you have to modify your standards somehow?
Mm-hmm. Sure. See, he couldn't come to any. He never came to a conference until. In fact, I don't think for the first couple of years he ever came to a conference. Maybe a late spring conference he got to, but he never came to the fall conference. That kind of thing. So we were always making exceptions for the thing. But we got a dandy when we got him, I'll tell you. And we can work around those things. See, it's like saying the guy has to go to a summer training program on that. That's a dumb thing, you know, just because he can't get to a summer training program. Maybe he's got to work. I'd rather have the guy work every summer for his 3 or 4 years in university and come out without a debt than I would when he comes out the other end with $3,000 or $4,000 in debt. Because, brother, it'll take him 2 years to get out of debt, at least, if he works real hard and gets a real good job. And we won't let him get a real good job, so... Man, leave him at home. Leave him at the city there, and give him 4 or 5 other guys to live with him. Let him run Bible study all summer long. Nothing wrong with that. Summer training programs are an asset, and they're an addition to the regular ministry. They are not the ongoing ministry. They're only a supplement. And let's not get psyched out on that one. There was another question back here somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that a lot of times we get guys and just give them all kinds of
Right now I'm working on a personal project of inviting all the graduates, or a good number of the graduates from my responsibility, to come to Chicago, and their assignment is to get the best job that they can possibly get for the education that they've got, what they've been trained in. If he's an engineer by training, then he gets, I want him preferably in the field of management if he can get it. Teaching, same thing, the best possible job he can. His main ministry will be where he works, where he lives, the apartment complex where he lives, and the local church. We will supplement, we'll have area Bible study for him, for that rare bird. We'll have rallies and the whole bit. And I think we're coming to the place where we need, and my idea here, Bo, is about a two-year holding pattern. So these guys can begin to grow whiskers and grow up a little bit. Plus, see, who's going to teach our guys management skills? Let me ask you that. Who's going to teach our navigator guys management skills? Not the navigators. You know, and all like, and see, a guy can really learn from business. Good night. If you go in there with the right kind of a spirit and the idea that you're going to really move ahead in that company for what you can learn so that you can contribute down the road to the navigators to the Lord's work, boy, business will teach you all kinds of things that you'll never learn around the navigators in terms of management and so on. And so let's... we need to see that. I'm taught that's being innovative. We've got to open up and get out of this rigid, locked-in type thinking. Go ahead. You were going to. No, it'll be loose in that their man-to-man time will be more on an as-needed basis. In other words, I'm not going to set up regular appointments to meet with these guys, but hopefully my assistant, who is a contact point. Although he doesn't have a particular responsibility, he will handle that, the organization of that, and so on. So it's not going to be backstroke. We're going to try to move into it. We're going to try and have single guys, you know, living with a team leader and single gals, but not the same kind of cranked up deal that you would have necessarily on a normal living type situation where some Christians with the same vision want to hang together and carry on. Let's see.
You're doing that with married couples,
too? Yes. Uh-huh. Same thing. Yeah, in fact, I got a tradesman I'm trying to get, and he's a real winner, you know, in terms of the guy's a carpenter and a painter and a what do you call, wall boarder, you know, that's kind of a good trade to be into. And I'm trying to, and he's been around about 4 years, and I'm trying to get him to come down and head up a little team of guys who want to get some skill and ability in trades. And so he'd take these guys and form his own little business. And so we're working on a number of different things and give these guys a couple of years, 2, 3 years, 5 years, whatever it takes to grow up and see, and also to get God's leading. See, I think it's too early. A guy's coming out of college. He's had no business experience. He hasn't had any opportunity to get out there and do something different. And we ask him to make an organizational commitment to the Navigators. Last question.
How about the military?
The military? You must be from the East Coast. Yes, very definitely. Yeah, we've got guys at University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. Joe and I sat down a career plan, two guys last year, and they're both in the Marines as officers this year for that purpose.
Yeah. Thoughts on when they got out?
Oh, yeah. We got a long string on them. If you guys down there in the south and the west would leave them alone, we'll get them back. But we're a little more realistic than that. We figured out that you guys bagged those guys. Yeah. No names either. Okay, well, listen, it's been great, and let's be on time tomorrow, and we'll just pick it up from where we are. Thanks very much.